Welcome to Barnyard Language, honest talk about running farms and raising families. We are Katie and Arlene, an Iowa sheep farmer and an Ontario dairy farmer, with six kids, two husbands, and a whole lot of chaos between us.
While this is a podcast for farm families, sometimes our content isn't for the whole family. So kick off your boots, reheat your coffee, and join us for some Barnyard Language.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Barnyard Language. It's that time of year. It's lamb watch. Katie, are there lambs yet? How many weeks have I asked this question?
Well, Arlene, it's really, really hard to break the habit of looking out the window, but I don't have to. For our non-Patreon folks, I'm pointing at my cell phone right now because finally, after 15 years of having sheep, I got my motherfucking barn cameras set up. And it's amazing because they work. They have infrared for nighttime, which I was like, yeah, maybe I'll be able to see that there are sheep in the barn. It's actually about as clear as it is during daytime.
Wow.
And that's with no supplemental light, which I was really surprised by. The cameras I got were, I think, $70 a piece, $80 a piece. So not that expensive. And thankfully, my friend Andy Cowan, who I've been friends with since high school, was able to fix my networking issues. I know that Andy listens to our show. So thank you. I really, really appreciate it.
Katie is smiling. She's very happy about this.
Turned out to be a cable I had left unplugged. And if I had had to call the local computer guys out, who know that I work in software, and had to pay them to drive out here to plug in one cable, I would have been very, very sad.
Plus, you would have had to pay for them to show up.
Plus, I would have had to pay for them. All I had to pay Andy was the promise of a lamb cam, if and when any damn lambs show up, which has not happened yet.
Now, does this also mean you can watch your husband while he's doing chores? And how does he feel about that?
I even have one set up in the driveway. Because from my office, where my monitors are and where the buildings are, I can't see the driveway or any part of the farmyard. So the dogs will tell me that someone is here, but not whether it's like my father-in-law or the Russians invading Red Dawn style. Like, they react the same way to...
Right, or that package that you've been waiting for weeks that you really want to meet the guy at the door with.
If it's like the FedEx driver who needs my signature, the dogs react the same way to everything. So yeah, now I can see the driveway. And yes, it turns out that the cameras do actually have a speaker built in.
Oh, dear.
I'm the worst person ever because I tested it last night without really thinking about it and scared the shit out of the sheep. And they refused to come back in the building for like 2 hours in the middle of the night.
I thought you were going to say you tested on without telling your husband that they had cameras. That would also be funny.
Oh, no, I'm going to do that before he hears this episode.
Oh, perfect. Surprise your father-in-law.
Yeah, I got to make sure his life insurance is up to date before I do it, just in case. I start wolf whistling at him from the house. So very, very exciting stuff, because this morning I was able to check sheep without getting out of bed, which at 1:30 in the morning during the peak of lambing season, we try to check them like every 2 to 3 hours usually. So the idea of being able to do that without having to put on a coat and boots and hike out there is very appealing.
That is very nice. But did you actually answer the question? Are there lambs?
No, there are no damn lambs.
There's just lamb cams.
Yeah, there's lamb cams. Jim's calendar says that we're expecting lambs on the 12th and not the 1st, which is what my calendar said. And today is the 11th.
Sounds like his is more accurate. Yeah.
His has to be more accurate since mine is so clearly not accurate. But the new moon was last night, I think, or tonight. And there's a lot of ewes out there kind of digging holes and shifting around uncomfortably and looking angry, which is basically their sign that lambing is getting closer. So any day now.
Any day now. I bet by next week's update, we'll have at least one.
Or it'll be like most years where like one goes and then like 4 days later, one goes and then like 20 of them go in one day. And then
sure, yeah.
There's that one that waits like another month and a half and then is like, oh, hey, a lamb. Sheep. Anyway, how are things at your place, Arlene?
Oh, things are going well. It feels very springy around here. It is our spring break, so the kids are off school for this week. And that is, I have realized, I feel like we should sign up. I know that you have them too, those Loop earplugs. I feel like we should sign up for an affiliate program because I am a fan as well, especially when my kids have friends over, because I want my kids to have friends over. It's fantastic. I think it's great. And they're older now. I don't have to supervise at every moment, but it's just so loud. And then they're all playing video games together. Or yesterday there was a Nerf battle going through the house, which also great. Go to it. Have fun. But it's my volume tolerance is a little lower than the people in my house. So yeah, the earplugs are fantastic. And they're the ones I have are like, don't block out all the sound, but just enough to take the edge off. So I don't want to like run from the house screaming myself.
We probably ought to get that affiliate code because we took the kids to our school puts on a senior class, puts on a carnival every year for all the kids in town. And it's like $5 and there's a bounce house and games and whatever. But when you pack that many small children that excited into a school gymnasium, I also was wearing my Loop earplugs and I was very, very grateful for them.
There's something about a school gymnasium that no matter how many kids are in there, I feel like I want to have earplugs.
Yep. But they are really nice because they just kind of...
I wonder how many teachers wear them all the time.
I would. Oh my God. Those people do not get paid enough. Yeah. Like there is no amount of money that you could pay a public school teacher where I would say, no, maybe that's excessive. Like maybe if you got into the high six figures, I would start to think that that was perhaps a little much. But there's plenty of folks make more for doing less.
But then, I mean... people play sports ball and earn a whole lot more money and they're not raising future generations. So what do we know about economics? What else has been going on? It feels like one of the major excitements of my week was going to get all of our passport applications in, which shows you how not exciting my week was. But I got them all submitted and didn't mess up too many times. Thankfully, I was able to go to a small town office and not have to drive into the city to drop them off. And the very nice people, I had got the first appointment of the day and I have 6 applications for our family. So one of them took 3 and the other one took 3. And any spot where there was a mistake, they just made a little note and I signed it and we got them all in and they accepted all the pictures. So looks like... not that we're even going anywhere, but I just wanted to get them done before everyone's passports expired and then you have to start all over again. So that felt like a major accomplishment.
So Arlene, what's your philosophy on passport photos? Are you one of those people who tries to take a good one or have you just given in?
Well, the rules are pretty strict. And you have to show your ears and you can't smile. I mean, I figure just like show up and get the picture done. It's more about making sure it doesn't get rejected. No one's going to see it other than the guy at the border.
I feel like the same way with the driver's license or I just got a new badge for work, that my passport photo, as terrible as it is pretty much what I will look like coming off any flight that requires a passport.
Yeah.
You know, my driver's license looks about like what I would look like if I got pulled over. So I figure it's pretty accurate.
Yeah, that's true. I guess our driver's license and health card both have the same photo. That one I might try a little bit harder because that's the one, well, I guess at the doctor, you know, chances are you're going to be sick if you're at the doctor, but there are other reasons you might have to go to the doctor. So that one comes out a bit more frequently. I won't say that I have had my ID checked very often, but you know, sometimes when someone wants to check your identity and would use your driver's license, not so much your passport. So I would put a bit more effort into that photo than my passport picture. But that was the big excitement of my week. So that just goes to show that it's a thrilling time. Actually, I shouldn't say that. We got invited to a euchre tournament at a friend's place. So that was more fun than going to get passport applications. But the passport applications felt like an accomplishment.
I feel like one of the things I did not anticipate about being an adult, and especially being an adult with a farm and small children, is how much I look forward to any boring days. Like any day where absolutely nothing happens is just like, basically a vacation at this point.
Yes. You know? Last week, there was a day where there was nothing written on the calendar. It was very strange. I kept thinking I was forgetting something. But there was this, this one solitary day where there was like, there was nothing there. There were no kids' activities. There were no interviews for the podcast scheduled, no meetings. It's very weird.
Strange.
Yeah, probably won't happen again for months, but it was there. It's still on the calendar. Should we go ahead and introduce our guest for the week?
I suppose we should.
Today, we are excited to be talking to Jen Colby, who's joining us from Vermont. I think our first Vermont guest. So Katie and I are working on a map, and so we get to color in another state. So that's exciting. So Jen, we start each of our interviews with the same question, and this is your intro to our listeners. So it is, what are you growing? So crops, livestock, kids, businesses, whatever you got. So Jen, what are you growing?
Oh, I think the things that I'm mostly growing these days, I grow sheep and I grow biodiversity and I grow pollinators and I have a whole bunch of businesses that I seem to be growing these days, but a lot of growth.
Jen is one of us.
That's right. So we like to talk numbers because that's how farmers are. So how many sheep are we talking about? It doesn't need to be precise because we know that numbers fluctuate.
Oh, it's all good. So I run somewhere between 20 and 30 ewes, and we have Katahdin sheep. So we sort of get maybe 30 lambs out of 20 ewes in a very low input sort of a system. And we lamb on pasture. So that's... Yeah. So not big, definitely not big. And the sheep are not a cornerstone of my business, but they are the cornerstone of my land management.
Right. So when you're talking about your businesses, what are they?
Oh, I do a few things. So I have a podcast as well, the Choosing to Farm podcast, and that's in very much a growth phase. And we offer farm stays on our farm and educational programming. And I'm in the process of getting a coaching certification. And I also run a very small one property Airbnb. So real estate as well. So we have a couple of different businesses that we do.
That is a lot of different things for sure.
It is.
Katie was doing a happy dance because she also has Katahdin sheep.
Yes.
So you can talk sheep after.
Yeah, we have between 30 and 40 ewes. And I like the idea that I could come for a farm stay and just do the same shit I would do at home.
Oh, goodness, yes.
But without my kids, I guess. So,
I was going to say, only if you find that to be relaxing, because I've had that conversation with some folks and they're like, I'm a farmer, I'm a rancher. I don't want to go to a farm or a ranch because that's not that relaxing to me. And I said, yeah. But when you go to somebody else's place, it's not your to-do list. So that actually is relaxing for a lot of people. So, you know, we'll see if they show up or not.
We actually stayed in an Airbnb that was on a sheep farm a few years ago. And understandably, they were very, don't go anywhere near the livestock. Which, I mean, like, it wasn't a farm stay. It was just an Airbnb that was on a farm.
Yeah.
Valid. But I found myself, you know, like when you're on a roof deck of a really high building and you're like, what if I jump accidentally? Like, I found myself like that with the livestock. I'm like, what if I forget that they're not mine and I pet one accidentally, or like I throw an apple to one accidentally, even though they're like on the other side of the property, you know, like what if I farm accidentally without even realizing it? Like, what if I sleepwalk and clean up some sheep shit while I'm here?
Is that okay?
I want to get a good Airbnb review because that's a that's also a goal of mine. But.
Well, we didn't anyway because the space is normally rented out for yoga groups. And so no one connected the fact that we were bringing two small children and that there is a massage studio downstairs and that the two small children on wood floors upstairs would be a very different experience than the middle-aged yoga ladies being upstairs.
That does seem like a hard combined use facility, though. I mean, because not every Airbnb guest is going to be perfectly quiet so someone can have a relaxing massage downstairs.
Yeah. Well, I think we were just the first time Nia Shoe had come up.
In a big way.
And I would imagine that we are hopefully the last time Nia Shoe comes up, because nobody was enjoying that anyway. We can get back on track now, Arlene.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, I have an Airbnb story, side story as well when you're ready.
So what is your background in terms of where you grew up and how you got into agriculture? Have you been a farmer forever, or is this more of a new thing, or what's your story?
Oh, goodness. So I was not born, and raised on a farm. We skipped two generations in my family. So my great-grandparents were dairy farmers. And then the last couple of generations with, you know, my grandpa and my dad were in the trades. And we did have some animals when I was growing up. And I always wanted to be a vet. I assumed I wanted to work with animals. And so when you're a little kid, the only thing that you know really necessarily, unless you grew up on a farm, is to be a veterinarian. So I went to school for that. And then I just sort of was becoming disenchanted with going on to vet school, and I don't know, it just didn't feel like the right thing to do. And I ended up working right out of college. I ended up working for an organic dairy company. And then we bought our first property at the end of working for that company. So I really enjoyed working with farmers. To the process of this, I figured out that I wanted to actually be a farmer. So when we bought our first house, I started testing all kinds of things on a very sort of homestead level, and tried lots of different livestock. I knew I wanted livestock. I tried vegetables. I eventually realized that I am a great CSA customer because I am a terrible vegetable grower, because as soon as live animals come, like the chicks would come in the mail, I would completely ignore all of the tomato starts and they would die. So so I enjoy a few different plants, but I'm definitely much more oriented toward perennial plants now, because they have a will to live that vegetables just don't seem to have.
Yeah, they can suffer a little bit more neglect, and you can return to them later.
Yes.
Yeah.
So we did that. I got the sheep there. We raised pigs for a long time there, steadily growing. And I always did sell to people. I was trying to figure out different business models. I went through different business planning schools, and we got to a point where it was an old house, and it was very moldy, and it was literally trying to kill my husband and my son. And we had to make a decision to say, either we're going to fix this house or we're going to find a new farm that's a better fit. And the farm geographically was a terrible situation. It was like 2 acres around the house and 38 acres across the road. It was steep. It was totally overgrown. There was a road and a blind corner in the middle of it. You know, when you have livestock and you're crossing them across the road, it was just not an ideal situation. It was like a Sunday morning with a grain bucket at 5 a.m. kind of move to get the sheep across the road.
And a child, for that matter.
And a child. So he was older by then, and he was able to help a little bit by then, which was really good, but he was not up at 5 a.m. So it was totally me. It was just all me. We used to try to block traffic, and then we just got to the point of like, no, I can do this. Like, I'm looking both sides. I can do this now. So we ended up deciding we were either going to move to town and just not farm anymore, or we were going to really go all in. And so we did a 3-year, we moved our sheep to town in a rental house for 3 years while we looked for the right farm.
So the sheep lived in the house?
No, but the sheep lived in the neighbor, in a neighborhood, which was super funny. We rented this house this little house that had like a 1 acre open space that was for sale, but nobody was using it. And the next place over were the actual owners of everything. And they were sort of folks we had known, and not well, but had known. And we said, you know, is it okay if we rent the house? Like, can we bring the sheep with us? And they were like, oh, sure, it's fine. It was in the middle of like just a suburban for Vermont kind of a neighborhood. I mean, it was in town, and there were moms and babies and grandmas who would like walk around with strollers, and they at lambing time, and they would stop. We went through 3 lambings there, just using shelters and hoop shelters, and like grandmas and little kids would like bring folding chairs and set them up next to the sheep pen. And I feel like it was so good for me and my outward reaching and interface. And then also it was really good for the sheep.
I bet the neighborhood was disappointed when they moved out.
They were super bummed. And even though we are like, we're not a mile from that neighborhood now, the final farm that we found was actually really close as well. It's close to town. But yeah, I don't think they, most of them haven't come up here, which is such a bummer because it was just, yeah, it was just kind of treasure thing. So we found this current farm 7.5 years ago, and it took us a while to get here and to get all of the paperwork done and all of that. But we finally got here, and we've been raising sheep and until recently pigs up here since then. So, and I ramped the farm up in businesses, and then I'm settling the farm down so I can pursue other things.
Yeah.
Whew, it's a lot. Plus also I had an extension career in there for 17 years as well. So a lot of this has been part-time stuff.
Yeah. The full-time job. And this is all on the side, right?
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
This has totally all been on the side. So I was in, I had been doing the homesteading side for probably 4 or 5 years. And I took a business planning class that was just this amazing 4-month intensive business planning class that used to be offered across the country. And if you do your homework every week, then you will end up with a business plan. It's sort of this great chunking it down kind of a thing. And I finished my business plan. I did all this work, and the upshot of the business plan was don't quit your day job.
It confirmed. Yeah.
It's confirmed. Don't do that. And I was like, okay, all right. I'm just gonna doubling down on my day job and stayed there for another 16 years after I did that business plan. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad I did it. I'm grateful. I learned a lot from a lot of people.
I feel like it can be really helpful to do a business plan after you've been doing business for a while, because
yes,
doing our business plans, the numbers tend to come out a lot more hopeful than reality is. And it's really nice to have the experience to know that just because the paper says X, Y, and Z does not mean that your bank will say X, Y, and Z. You know, either your banker or your bank account might not align with what the numbers say is possible.
And when I went back to do all of that and do all of it again, what was that, 12 or 13 or 14 years later to get to this farm, there were some like real realities there that did make it hard for us to get this location. It took a lot of work to get here.
Well, I think folks really underestimate too, especially, well, with crops and livestock, how much more management it can be to, you know, because you look at the paper and the paper says, if I get 20 more cows, I'll make so much more money. But it does not reflect the labor or the time or any of the human inputs of doing a thing, which I think is the problem with business planning, is it tends not to reflect the family part of the family business. You know, it might reflect the business part pretty well, but the family part is not always.
Mm-hmm. So Jen, I've been listening to your podcast, which as you said, is called Choosing to Farm, right? Can you tell us what the inspiration was behind your show and who you're talking to?
Oh, absolutely. So when I fell into this and started to do my own thing, because I hadn't grown up on a multi-generational farm, there were things that I never really learned about. You know, I never learned how to drive a tractor. I never learned a lot of basic, I had an animal science degree, which was useful to understand why some things might happen, but I had very little practical application in lambing or, you know, a lot of different moving pigs from place to place, you know, getting them onto a truck, those kinds of like real practical everyday farmer things. And as I went around, this is largely during my extension career, as I went around, and my job was to organize pasture walks, I did grazing and livestock work, and I spent a lot of time with folks realizing like I was having to learn everything from scratch. And I really thought I was alone. I absolutely thought like there's, you know, I was jealous for a very long time of multi-generational folks. They learn to do all these things when they're so young. And here I am with this bigger mountain to climb because I'm learning all of this fresh. And I started to talk to more people who are largely second career people who are coming in their 30s, 40s, 50s, who would call me from Extension and they would say, like, I don't really know anything, but I want to learn how to do this. And they would come to pasture walks too. So we would start to have these conversations. And then I started to work more regionally. And then I joined the Ranching for Profit school and started to meet folks across the country and some folks in Canada as well would come down to the school. And what I was finding is that there is this whole movement. I thought I was this weird little alone person who was trying to start a new thing. And it turns out there's a whole movement of us. And some of us are people who don't have any ag in our background who just say, we're just going to do this. And there are folks who can't work it out with their families, who are multi-generational, and they're striking out on their own. There are people who've, like me, who've skipped a couple of generations. And so all of us are here trying to support each other, recognizing that we just have a really different experience than folks who've grown up in sort of the more traditional ag ways. So that's it. So the podcast is really, it's much less a technical podcast. I love technical podcasts too. We can learn so much from them, but I am really about the human stories, the origin stories of how did we get here and why are we doing this and how are we managing profitable businesses? Because it's okay to talk about that, which is weird because we don't talk about that in farming. Like I find that is sort of a thing. And like, how do we create success in our farming businesses and our lives? So, which is partly how I found you two, because I love that you also talk about the real life part, not just the farm part, but the family part and all of the complications that go along with trying to do this.
And like you said, the community piece too, right? Where we can all feel really alone in our communities because there's less of us who are farming. And there, you know, like if you look around, you know, I look around the schools where my kids go and there's a handful of other farming families, but for the most part, you know, they're living in town or might be living rurally, but they're not in agriculture. And there is just something different about those of us who are trying to live this lifestyle. So what are some of the things that you're learning from your first and skip generation farmers? Are there things that you think that some of these first or skip generation people are doing really well that some of us maybe who are multi-generational are lacking or aren't doing because of whether it's tradition or, you know, like keeping up with what our parents or grandparents want us to do, that kind of stuff? What are some of the lessons that you're getting from your guests and from your own experiences?
So one of my first takeaways has been that I'm not jealous of multi-generational folks anymore. I think we just have really different experiences because what I'm learning from the fresh people and also from the multi-gen people is that when you're starting out fresh, you can create anything that you want. And so some of the people that I've been talking with, they're not carrying the weight of any expectation. They also don't have any equity necessarily. So there's like a real balance on that.
Yeah. You can do what you want, whatever, or what you can pay for.
Exactly.
Which I suppose is the case for most of us, but yeah, especially so if you, yeah.
It's true. And so what I'm seeing is there's some of this like pulling apart of what's traditionally been done and reimagining that. So, I mean, I talked to a fellow who's doing gangbusters, raising ducks and geese and really unusual, not unusual fowl, but not necessarily the traditional, you know, in barns. I mean, a lot of pasture raised folks, partly because I think that is a methodology that they are oriented toward because they're oriented toward regenerative agriculture and more biodiversity and that sort of management. But also they don't have money to build a $1 million barn. So they have to be creative. And some of that is also including a lot of like creative financing, creative access onto land. I've talked to a bunch of folks who are primarily leased land operations. You know, they may own their own house, but it's only on an acre or two, and they are working with all of this leased land. Custom grazing, you know, they don't necessarily have to own the animals that they're managing. So I've just really been appreciating all of the creativity because these are clearly folks that are driven to do what they do. And they're figuring out new ways to do it because the old ways aren't working anymore. And maybe this is just an indicator of the folks that I've been attracting to the podcast, but there's been a lot of direct consumer people. Not always, you know, folks with a farm store, not always, you know, solely direct, but a lot of people who interface with the public in some way, even if that's, you know, social media or mailing lists or human contact. Yeah. So that's also feels to me like, you know, a little different than the multi-generational folks that I have grown up knowing, which are in Vermont is largely dairy. You know, those are in Vermont and dairy. There's not a lot of, you know, public interaction in that. And so there's a lot of cow interaction, but there's not a lot of human interaction in the dairy farmers that I have known.
I muted myself while I was chasing the dog out. My my 2-year-old Aussie Jen has learned that if she hits my office door hard enough, it will open and she can come in here and try to eat the guinea pigs, which is less than ideal for everyone involved.
Especially the guinea pigs.
Especially the guinea pigs, who really stand to lose the most here, I guess. Anyway, as I was saying, as a skipped generation farmer who married into a generational farm, I feel all of what you're saying. I think the upside is that I can learn to drive a tractor a lot easier than my husband can learn to ignore his dad and all the neighbors who've known his family for the last 100 years. And I feel like the upside, and maybe especially as a relatively younger woman, at least when we started, that there's a real power in being underestimated. Because if people think you're an idiot, either things will go horribly, and they're right, and they feel good about that, or things will go really well, and you're right, and they learn something. And I think there's so much to be said for not knowing how many things stand in your way at some point. Like, there's obviously a line there of willful ignorance and stupidity and being downright dangerous. And, you know, there's definitely things people should learn. But like the first cow we got, I didn't know she was a free Martin when we got her. We had, you know, she was a gift. We were supposed to be raising her for beef. I got her bred because nobody told me that she shouldn't be able to breed. And now 12 years and 8 calves later, you know, she's still just cranking them out because nobody told her either that she was supposed to be infertile. So, you know, nobody told us, so we're just going for it. But I think too, I like what you said about being honest about managing profitable farm businesses, because I feel like it's such a thing like your farm doesn't have to make any money. But if you're not making any money, you shouldn't be setting yourself up as an example for people who do expect to be making money. Tell them it's an expensive lifestyle. Like, people have all sorts of weird, expensive hobbies. That's totally, absolutely fine. But I meet so many people who are mentoring younger farmers who say, well, you won't get rich. And I'm like, do we mean you won't be the next Jeff Bezos? Or do we mean you're going to be begging for change in the grocery store parking lot after farmers markets, not getting rich? Like, in my normal career, I might not know to the dollar what people get paid, but I can get real close. And I don't think we do anybody any favors by not throwing at least some loose numbers out there of what you're making and what's expected, because that's also how people get screwed over. You know, when we don't talk about incomes and salaries and things, it makes it really easy to take advantage of people.
I think even when you're talking about multi-generational farmers, Jen, about not being envious of those, sometimes that's the issue too, right? Is it's your previous generation who's not being honest about what the numbers are, and whether that's shame or pride or who knows what that's rooted in, or fear that the next generation's going to leave if they really know what the true situation is. But so much of the frustration and, you know, secrecy that sometimes happens around succession planning, I think, is around trying to hide the reality of what the numbers actually are and not really wanting to talk about the fact that maybe we can't make this work, but we really want to. So we'll just push that down the line and maybe not talk about it and hope that, you know, somehow it's just going to magically solve itself. Who knows what the end goal is, but yeah.
It seems like, Arlene, to a lot of families are not prepared for what even I was surprised by is the amount of having to face up to decisions that have been made over the last 100 years and having to have a really honest conversation about the long-term impacts of some of those decisions.
Podcasts are free to listen to, but they aren't free to create. Katie and I would appreciate your support as we work to build the Barnyard Language community.
Patreon is an easy way for you to make a contribution that goes directly to making the show. As a member of our Patreon community, you get to watch the video version of our weekly updates, complete with questionable hairstyles and clutter. With 3 levels of support, you can choose a tier that works for you.
Keep the podcast going by becoming a patron today at patreon.com/barnyardlanguage.
So I went through the ranching for profit school, which is largely in the Western U.S. Like the Easterners have to go out there, have to fly out there. But there's a follow-up program, which is like an annual, essentially accountability program. And so you're in boards with these other businesses and talking through some really, really important and tough things and some tough love, because, you know, sometimes you're able to get questions that your family can't ask you, but your business members are like, board members are like, we're here to help this business survive, not necessarily to be friends. And so some really hard questions get asked, and I stopped being jealous because I see the weight of those decisions, Katie, like you're talking about. Yeah. And sometimes that actually means that in order to save the personal relationship, the business actually has to move someplace else, or the new generation has to go someplace else and start their own because they can't bear the weight of their family decisions in the past. It's really rough. I don't envy anybody. I think no matter what, it's a challenge.
So I want to hear that Airbnb side story now, because we're down to the agritourism part, which, God love them. Part of me, like, when we do have people come out to the farm, you know, especially for lambing, or they see fresh calves, or it's a nice day, and you're like, oh, God, more people, you know, people are like, oh, this is so great. And then I think about having people on our farm, like, on a regular basis, or when there's, like, what do you do about agritourism when it's muddy as shit? And you have dead animals and you're like up to your elbows inside a sheep. Then what? Jen's just rethinking this entire agritourism thing. She's like, actually, that's a good point. I'm out.
I am not. But I do. It's very interesting. I do try to manage a little bit of that. So one of the things is we don't do agritourism with tours. Like I used to do that. I tried to do that when I left my extension job about 3 years ago and have been growing these other businesses since then. And so the first year I threw myself into doing all of the enterprises on the farm that I ever thought I would do, which was 6 different things. And it was crazy. And I stopped most of them. That day job was just holding me back. Yeah.
If it was only 6, that's pretty restrained. Like, I feel like enterprise math is...
They were the top 6 because I couldn't make a top 3 or top 2.
Because it was going to be your full-time job and now you could fill all the hours of the day.
Enterprise math is like chicken math. Like, it's basically the same thing.
My brain just exploded. That's absolutely true. Enterprise math is like chicken math.
Jen, I can tell we're the same person too, because I know that our brains work enough already in this, like, what, 28 minutes that we've been talking, to know that it is legit that, you know, so I started knitting, I started crocheting. And then, like, the next thing from that is that you start spinning and you start dyeing yarn yarn. And then you have to buy sheep. But I already have sheep, but they're hair sheep. They don't make wool. And I can feel this yawning chasm of a rabbit hole opening in front of me as I try to explain to my husband that although we have, you know, 40 ewes and then we have like 80 lambs, so we have like 120 sheep, that none of them are suitable. So I need to buy different sheep, which will then have to be shorn. And then I will have all this yarn. It is not anyway, agritourism.
Yes. Yes, and I actually have started to do something similar to that in my agritourism, so I'm taking a pause this year. So this totally might vibe. So I had a dream when we bought this farm that, or the different iterations of this farm, we looked at it in different locations. I was like, I really want to do agritourism and I want to host a yurt. I want to have a yurt and I want to host people who stay up on the farm. And I grew up in a town in central Vermont that has like a very famous U.S. landmark that is a working farm. And I didn't want it to be that. Like, it's a fine working farm, but I didn't want tours. I didn't want, you know, milking demos. I didn't want that kind of interpretive experience. I didn't want to do that. I just wanted to create a space where people could come and just be. And they could just naturally come see the animals if they want to see the animals, look at the views if they want to look at the views, or just stay inside and read a book, didn't care. So just to be here would be enough. And it's kind of been my operating principle, is just to be here is to be enough. And so my job is to create a nice environment for them to just be able to come and be. So it took a lot to get the yurt up. We had to do two different fundraising campaigns and we used a bunch of different money, and we did a Kickstarter, which failed. We did an iFund Women, which was successful, but didn't cover all the costs. And we finally got the yurt ordered in the fall of 2019, and it arrived Christmas week of 2019, and in its boxes, and we were going to install it in the spring of 2020. It was actually going to be put up by the yurt company. So then nobody could come to Vermont because he was in New Hampshire. So we had to put together a group of friends to help raise the yurt. And we finally got it like finished and railings on the deck and that kind of stuff in 2021. So I've been running the yurt about 3 years and absolutely love that. And I love that we kind of went a little upscale with it. It's not crazy upscale. It's off the grid, but it doesn't feel so much like it's off the grid. Like, we have rechargeable power and we have some solar lights and we have a composting toilet inside that's very nice. So nobody has to go outside to pee, which is a non-starter for a lot of the folks that we attract, because we attract a lot of folks from Boston and New York City and New Jersey. And they just want to get away. And so that has just worked amazingly. And our farm is a very steep farm. It's a very like ledgy, it's perfect for sheep. I couldn't possibly grow a crop here at all. Like, there's just no tillage of any kind. But it has great views. So how do we use this farm to maximize the views? So we started with the yurt, and the yurt has been going really well. And people can drive up to it and they can't see the house and the house can't see it. So it's got this sort of great thing happening. And then we added in a tent platform site as well. And this is where I'm like, but then we could do this and then we could do this. And so then I started to get all these.
Jen, I'm coming here to tell you too that my in-laws took a yurt building class and now have a yurt for sale if you know anyone who needs another one. It's apparently not that hard to set up.
They are not.
But I've been refusing to set it up because I know that it will go the same route of, well, if we have a yurt, you know, it's a real Dr. Seuss situation, you know.
It sort of is. And then I went down a different rabbit hole because I've become this, like, not only a yurt enthusiast, but just this farm stays enthusiast in general, that I think that we need to get more people onto our farms. And this is how they connect with food. You know, we don't even have to give them tours. If they just come here and they're like, oh, look at you, you're working hard, it's beautiful, I want to buy from you, or I want to support you in some way, or I'm going to follow you on Instagram, or, you know, they're making whatever connections they want to. So then I started to become this like effusive farm stays person, and people started asking me, all these farmers started asking me, like, how do you do this? So I started to tell them. And then I created a course, an online course for it. So sometimes, a couple times a year, if I'm feeling like people are asking a lot, then I will run a new course. And now I'm just like turning the course into a book, because I feel like there's like people who want to know. So now this is the like deep rabbit hole. I'm starting to do sites from different platforms. And by that, I mean, like, so our yurt is on standard Airbnb. Our campsite is a tenter campsite, which is a little bit of a mixed bag these days, because I think Tenter just filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy in January. So I don't know if it's going to stay a tenter campsite. Maybe not. And then I've been looking at Hip Camp, and I've been looking at Harvest Hosts. And so I've had some of those folks in the course, like in a Zoom call, just to sort of do a Q&A. And I'm like, how do we try out? Cause there's pros and cons to all of them. This is what I'm taking a break on. Because I'm like, okay, this is a deep rabbit hole. If I am on four or five different platforms with four or five different sites, and each of them have different tax reporting, and each of them have, you know,
I like this though. It feels like that children's book about, you know, if you give a mouse a cookie, you give a homesteader a farm with a rock in the middle of it, and before you know it, they're writing a book about yurts. Like, that tracks. That absolutely tracks.
So true. Oh my gosh. And I was so proud of myself, because I avoided that. Well, that I started knitting, so then I need wool sheep, so then I need this. Like, I was like, I avoided that trap, and then I then go down a totally different trap.
But if you had sheep, you could make your own wool and then make your own yurt out of your own sheep's wool. I'm just saying.
Oh my God. Yeah. Oh my God.
Yeah.
My worlds collide.
Arlene, we should introduce her to Cody and Thomas, because they started with, what, 7 chickens, and now they own an ice cream store? You know, like, totally the same sort of avalanche.
That's super fair. And ultimately, so what we're realizing is that I think we probably will add a couple more tent sites, because tent sites are easy. They're inexpensive to get into. And when you pick one platform that works for you, then multiple sites makes a lot more sense than a different site for each platform. But what we want to do sometime in the next 5 years is really create a retreat center at this farm, and have some programming that's here. And so we're going to start to build some cabins, not this year, but next year. There's some great little cottages that are pre-cut that you can put together from a Southern Vermont company, and you can just get all the pieces shipped to you. And I think that we're going to start to create some some cabins and maybe a couple tent sites, just because I can't help myself. But
so, not to have you teach your entire course right now, but if someone is like in the early stages of thinking about farm stays, what are some questions that you need to ask yourself, or like some like really preliminary like things to think about?
Yes. So the place that I often, the biggest question that I often get from folks is, how much time will this take? And so that's actually a thing that I have some exercises for folks to think about, the way that their time gets spent and what they want to do. And the person who the farmer who hosts, or rancher, you don't have to necessarily like people. Like, I feel like there's a little bit of that barrier of like, well, how much time is this going to take? And I don't really like people anyway, but how can I make money from them? You know, and from using my place. And I don't think that those are necessarily like non-starters. It's that if you're not a people person, who can you get to be your people person? Because the host may be the best repairs and maintenance person in the world. And so somebody else needs to just manage the customer, you know, the visitor interaction. that's totally fine to do that. But for folks to think about the time that's involved in this, because there is the building or setup time, depending upon what it is, it might take quite a lot. There's going to be the people interaction time. There's going to be the turning time, the flipping time in between different guests, unless you truly have a bunkhouse and they bring in all of their stuff. But probably you still want to have somebody in between who sweeps it or make sure that the site's not trash, that kind of thing. And then marketing time, because there was a time where we could just throw these things up in the world onto one website someplace, and then we'd be fully booked. And that's actually not the world that we live in anymore. Like, we do have to have a little bit of a presence. We need to work with, an aggregator, somebody like Airbnb or somebody like Farmstays US who people know to go to. So there's some marketing pieces of that. And then there's maintenance. And so those are all just pieces, like, just to break out, what does it look like, that time commitment, and does that feel like something that you even want to start? And then we do talk about the money, and we do talk about how to get these things going fast, fast in a relative way. And sometimes you have to go slow to go fast. So sometimes you have to start inexpensive so that you can get great reviews so that you can then charge what you need to charge. And that's not always easy for folks to hear, but it's an important part of the process, I think.
Yeah, that's true too. Yeah. What about the bureaucracy side? I know that it's different depending on the state and even the county or township or whatever, but how big of a factor was that for you specifically? Like, was that part difficult, or was your area relatively easy to work with?
So ours was pretty easy to start with. Depending upon what you're doing, it can be considered a temporary structure or a permanent structure, and a temporary structure oftentimes has different local requirements on that, local or state. And I always do recommend that folks check with what are the state regulations or what are their town regulations. Vermont doesn't do a lot of county. We don't have a lot of county interference, but a lot of the states in the U.S. do have a lot of county, level government where they want things as well. And keep track of how things might be changing, because just for an example, so there's a new proposed bill in Vermont I just found out about very recently, where they're looking to put in a requirement that folks live in their short-term rentals for at least 30% of the time. And farms are in Vermont are considered separate, and farm stays are considered to be accessory on-farm businesses. And that's been some recent legislation, which has, been very supportive of farm businesses. But those farmers who own something that's off-farm might be subject to this. And, I have an off-farm Airbnb. It's my mom's house. Like, am I a giant corporation bucking the system? No, I'm a person who bought my mom's house, and I'm trying to have a side business with that. So keep an eye on what the local stuff, what's going on in the state or county or territory or region.
Yeah, those are good points.
Jen, I like what you said too about the geography of your farm stay being that the yurt is not visible from your house and your house is not. That you have that separation, because our farm is a very typical Midwestern farm where it is fairly flat and the house is in the center of it. So there's, unless you go way back into woods, which is completely inaccessible and surrounded by other people's properties, there's nowhere to put a farm stay structure that would not be like in our front yard. And that is definitely a very different feeling than, if you have geography, whatever, where it makes sense to have something a little further away. Because, that's always been our issue with having folks on farm, is that our house is in the middle of the farm. And it's, you lose privacy pretty fast that way. And we wouldn't live out here if we wanted people in our front yard.
Yeah, the privacy piece was something that we talked about quite a bit when we started talking about just having guests. And we both agreed we don't ever want to host folks in our house. Like, there are, there's certainly the bed and breakfast. I know farmers talk to farmers who have this, terrific bed and breakfast on their farm. And often they're dairy farms, but not always. And I feel like that's a piece that, that wasn't a good thing for us. We're introverted enough that we need to like warp. And the podcast guests can't see me, but I'm like making a, a pressing down, like a nesting kind of a, a shape. And we just didn't want to do that. And we also realized like, we want to be able to take a shower in the upstairs bathroom without people like staring at us, which, you know, which is fine because we want them to have privacy too. And so as we've been looking at locations for these cottages that we want to build, I think we've got three, and they all have a view that is separate out to a different place. And even though they can see each other when they're up on the top of the farm, the windows are going to be different. The windows are going to be angled to be like, this is where you're at so that you feel like you have privacy when you come up here.
And that's nice too, when the view isn't just another cabin.
Right.
Because like, how relaxing is this?
Right.
Look at these people. Isn't this great?
The people, they're getting away from the people.
So you've been saying we a lot, and I listened to one of your episodes the other day about you and your husband. I'm assuming that's the other part of we. And you were talking about the idea that while he was very supportive of your desire to farm, he did not necessarily want to be a farmer himself. So I was wondering if you have any advice for other couples who are in that situation, because we don't always fall in love with someone and their career. And in farming, that's not always the easiest thing to separate from the person. But just because you might love a farmer doesn't mean that you want to be a farmer. So do you have any advice for other people who might be in similar relationships?
Yeah, boy. My advice, and speaking as the farmer in the side of this, is that I definitely have learned, he has taught me to communicate a whole lot more about what my expectations are. And when he communicates back his expectations, to actually listen to that. Because I, you know, for a long time, I said, oh, I'm going to, you know, we raised a few chickens and we did some, you know, it was, you know, very, very homestead scale, just trying different things. And he was like, you go, you do you, that's great. And as things got bigger and suddenly there were things, I would need help moving things or chicken processing day, you know, we talk about in that podcast. And I, again, was feeling a little jealous of these other folks, these other couples that I would see, and they would be out there together and everybody would be in like their chicken processing gear, and it was wet and cold or hot or wet, and it was just long. Chicken processing is long.
Chicken processing's not going to be, no matter the weather, it's not a fun day.
It is not fun. And I happened to pick a place that was on the backside of the garage and it got no lights. So it was cold earlier and dark earlier and it sucked. It just sucked. And I was like super bummed because he would say, you know, I'm not going to help you with that. And I was like, what kind of boundaries are those, buddy? Like, wait a minute. Like, but it was because he knew that he was like, I didn't, you're choosing to do this and I don't want to do this and I don't have to do this. And I was like, well, you should. So I, full disclosure, I was like, dude, come on. Like, but the truth is he didn't want to do that. And the fact that he was like, I love to cook, I will make sure that there is hot food for you when you come in and you're exhausted. And then I realized that those couples that were processing chickens together, they would then come home and like eat, I don't know what, because they would fight over who was least exhausted to then make dinner, and take care of the other one. And then I kind of realized that so much of it was about the expectation of it and about the appreciation of it. So now we communicate a lot, and actually he's a lot more helpful in certain places and certain things that he's doing. And he's like, would you like help with this? He'll actually ask. And I will ask for his help when it's really important. And so I don't ask all the time, and I try not to ask out of desperation because I don't want it to be that level. But when I say, hey, would you mind giving me a hand? I'd really appreciate it. And then it's a distinct thing and he helps, and then he feels good because he helped. I feel good because I had help, because I often don't have help. And but I'm not expecting he's out there with me all the time. And I've had to let that go. And I'm okay with that. I mean, I do hope he comes out more often because it's just, I enjoy his company, but I'm trying to be a lot more respectful that just because I am called to farm and I do feel like it's a calling, I was always pulled to do this. I don't feel like he has to feel like that too.
I bet. Yeah.
It's been a real journey, over the last 20 to 25 years. Our son is almost 26. So, by the time the podcast comes out, he will be 26. So it's been, and we started the year that he was born.
Yeah. You just threw yourself in there. Lots of,
yeah. It's like, sure. I had a baby and I've got this new place and I just changed jobs. Sure. Why not just start a farm too? Okay.
Top six list of things I want to do with my life right now.
Right now, today.
All right. So sorry, I'm lost over here. The isolation from becoming parents is a lot of why we started this show. So how was that for you? And also, I assume that you were like 12 when you had this kid, if he's 26. You're just like, the fresh Vermont air must be much kinder than the Midwest. I don't know.
Thank you. No, I'm 53. I had him when I was 27.
Sorry, I didn't mean to just like pry into how old you are. It's like, what's your blood type and your pant size, Jen? Let's get real personal here.
O positive. I don't know what my hand size is, but it's not big.
Oh, I said pant size, but okay.
Oh, pant size. Oh, yeah.
It's like, I don't know what my hand size is.
Depends upon the day.
Good call. Good call. All right.
And women's clothes, the brand, right? Like, who knows?
Oh, the brand. It's insane. Anywhere from a 12 to a 24, depending upon the brand.
Yeah, that's right.
Whether Mercury's in retrograde, who knows? Yes. Anyway.
Yeah. So, gosh, I wish your podcast had been around when I had first had my son, or even any time earlier than my finding you just recently, because it was really lonely. It was really lonely to be out there and. So I worked full time. I just have one child and I had this dream of farming. And so I did that sort of outside of work hours. I started all of that. We bought our place when I was 7 months pregnant. And so we had him in the winter, and then the next spring I was like, okay, me and my baby, we're going outside. We're going to build a chicken coop. And then me and my baby, we're going to go do this other thing. And that worked just as long as he was a regular napper inside, like his little baby thing. And that lasted about 4 months. And
those babies, once they move through stages real fast, right?
He didn't nap and he didn't want to be outside. He hated it in the heat. He hated bugs. He never wanted to work in the garden. I feel like this is maybe like the like cussing and complaining section because I had this dream of sharing my farming love of farming with my son who had none of it. And he's much more computer oriented, much more inside oriented, much more like a super techie mechanical brain, loves video games, does 3D printing. Like he's a wonderful, amazing person who takes after my husband so much more than me. And I was like, oh, I'm out here like moving chicken tractors in a driving rainstorm in the dark while the family is inside. And it was that was super, super isolating in itself. And I felt a lot of times I felt like if we came home, I picked him up from daycare and we came home after work and I had to feed the chickens or I had to do something with the pigs and he was hanging in the house for a good chunk of his childhood. And then I would finish up what I was doing outside with the animals and then come in and make dinner. So, and my husband had during that period when my son was growing up, he worked for a nonprofit that did a lot of night meetings. So he worked with a lot of communities in our region. And so they had night meetings. So he had to go do those. So it was a lot of time with my son and I. And I felt like I just like let him down all the time, that I just wasn't there. And, you know, I talked to him about it now. And I'm like, I'm sorry I wasn't there more. And he's like, oh, it's fine. Are you kidding me? I was like killing myself for years because years of guilt. Exactly. Because I felt like I wasn't there for you. And he's like, no, it's fine. I played with my toys and then you came and made dinner. It was not a big deal, Mom. And I'm like, okay, well, thank you.
I think to Jen, that betrayal you're expressing of when your kid isn't just obsessed with the thing that you loved, because I have one child who is now playing Farm Simulator with his daddy every night. It's their thing. They've gone from playing tractors to like buying tractors to playing Farm Simulators. Kid's five. Okay. Like you can tell how this is going. And then I have another kid who's so much like me in some ways, but then I'm like, we're going to read tonight because she loves books. And I'm like, here is some Roald Dahl in all his fat shaminess because I love him so much. She doesn't give a shit. She doesn't care at all. And I'm just like, how did you live inside my body? Literally half of your genetics are mine. And you don't love the thing I love? Really?
Right.
How ungrateful are you? Right. I made you. The least you can do is like the book I like.
I think, too, there's sometimes this expectation. I've got a kid or a couple of kids that sound a bit like yours who are, you know, they'll do the chores that are required of them, but they don't love it. And they have a lot of other interests, but the farm is not one of them. But we have this, and I think social media sometimes feeds into it, this impression of like, all the children are going to love the farm and it's the very best thing. And they're out, you know, playing in the mud every day. And some kids are not like that, you know, like the fear of the wasps. And then they're inside the house because they can't bring themselves to go back out. Or, you know, like, yeah, they'll help you with that one chore, but then they're asking when they can go back inside or can do something else. And, you know, we get this impression of like the farm is the most beautiful place to raise children. And in lots of ways it is, you know, like there's lots of great things, but the kids don't always appreciate it as much as we think they should.
Arlene, I think I just figured out the problem is that Instagram tells us that for our kids to love the farm, they need like straw hats and linen dresses and pinafores and shit.
Oh, I don't have any of those things.
Have we been dressing them wrong?
Yeah, maybe that's it.
Like, your kids might be a little old to start this now that they're, like, in high school. It might be a little awkward.
They need to dress like they're Amish.
Yes. If they're dressed like they're Huck Finn, then they will love it. I'm going to try this with my kids, see if that helps matters.
I'm feeling like there's a particular Instagram account that you might be referring to right now.
There's
quite a few, yeah. So even though we're saying all of this, what was your favorite thing about raising your son on the farm? I'm sure there were elements of it that you and he both enjoyed.
Absolutely. And the irony is, so our son rents a room from us. He likes living on the farm. He doesn't actually want to be a farmer, but he goes to his job and he comes home and he likes living in a rural place. He likes knowing where his food comes from. And the irony is that when I go away on a travel trip, he is been taking care of the animals. And he doesn't mind doing that. Like, he's not going to run out there and trim sheep hooves, but he'll throw food and water at them and he'll let me know if somebody looks kind of sick. And I think that he really appreciates that. Like, he wouldn't do it if he didn't want to do that. So I really think that he has this appreciation for living in a rural place and being surrounded by real things. And mm-hmm. I don't know that he would have gotten that otherwise.
That's true. And then I feel like if you need someone to live in your yurt 30% of the time, then you can be like, could you please just live in the yurt for a little while? The government says we have to.
I don't think there's enough power up there for his gaming needs. Right. I think he can't run on the battery long enough.
Maybe grandma's Airbnb.
Right. Yes. Yes. That would work.
I can confirm now that a remote tech job with good benefits is an excellent way to support a farm. Because, you know, it's in case he feels called to it later. You know, having that health insurance is real nice. So what are some of your biggest parenting struggles besides trying to get your 26-year-old son to wear cut-off overalls and a straw hat with his cane pole? If you ever need him out of your house, you can present him with a new outfit and see how that goes over.
Oh my goodness, he would not even. So some of my biggest struggles were that I was doing a lot of it on my own because of my husband's night meetings. And I felt like, you know, some of my biggest struggles were that I felt like I had to choose sometimes the farm or my family. And I don't know what that experience is like for women who are in a more support role on a farm where they're not the primary farmer. I just know my experience as the primary farmer was like, so if I don't go outside, things are going to die. If I don't come inside, things are going to die. And like the pull between that was like, sometimes I felt like I had to recognize that if I didn't, that I couldn't go outside and that maybe something bad would happen because I needed to be there for my son. And sometimes I felt like I was just abandoning him because I had to go outside. That was like really tough. That was really, really tough. Yeah. I mean, there were really wonderful things in that, like first time that he saw chicken processing, he was like 3 years old and he was with another little kid. I was co-processing with some friends and farmer friends, and they were dairy farmers, and their kid was like a year younger than mine. And the two kids were like playing in the gizzards and they were totally loving that. It was no problem whatsoever. And, you know, we used to cut up pigs on the counter and stuff like that. And he'd be like, oh, cool. What's the pig over there? Like it was, those are like the good parts of it. But the bad parts of it were when I felt like just like a really crappy parent because I was choosing one or the other.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I'm going to ask this question and we can cut it if you don't want to answer it or if it's too personal. I feel like there's an expectation, especially around farmers, that we have big families.
Oh, yeah.
And whether it was by circumstance or choice or whatever, it doesn't really matter. But having an only child, was there either judgment or even, you know, like internally that feeling of like, we should have more kids because we live in the country. And I don't even really understand where that comes from. I guess kind of that historical, like we need more farmhands to help us kind of thing. But did you have any feelings around that?
Wow. What a great question. So maybe because I didn't grow up in a multi-generational family, I didn't feel that pressure. Also, I am an only child myself and was the only grandchild on my dad's side. So somehow that seemed really normal to just have the one kid. But we didn't have any set expectations about how many kids we were going to have. We were like, I know I want to have a kid. Like, and my husband was like, okay. And, you know, we were in our 20s. So he was just like, whatever you want is great. And so we had our son, and partly because I have historically had a habit of taking on probably too many things at once because I get excited about them. You know, I worked full time and I had started the farm stuff and had our son, and we had sort of an old house. So there was like the challenges of an old house too. And there just never seemed to be a good time to have another kid. And it was like, oh, I'm just so exhausted right now. He's one. Like, I'm not ready to get pregnant again. And then it'd be like, oh, and now he's two and he's just starting to do stuff. And now he's three and he's thinking he might be out of diapers. And like, so there would be these, like, I just can't face going back into it again. And then 10 years went by and we were like, I think we're not going to have another kid.
Looks like he's an only child. Yeah.
Looks like he's only child. And it's interesting. And I never really thought about that farming culture of large families, but somehow the idea of having multiple kids seemed overwhelming in itself in a situation that felt a little overwhelming. And I wasn't ready to embrace that overwhelming. And I really So the irony is that growing up, my son's best friend is the oldest of four kids. And so we spent a lot of time in his, and that kid's mom is one of my best friends too. And like, and watching the family grow up and with four kids, and our son Connor is just like, spent a bunch of time with them. And he was like, I spent a bunch of time with them and that was great. And now I'm home and it's just the three of us and it's great. It's quiet. It's good. And it's like,
and I have my own room.
Yeah. So
no one's stealing my stuff.
No. And he never, and it was interesting because I asked him sometimes if he would like to have another, you know, a sibling. And he was like, I'm good. I was like, okay. which is interesting because my mom wanted to have more kids and she wasn't physically able to have more kids. So I was an only, and which I don't regret not having siblings either. So
I feel like to me sometimes that we have two, and honestly, I think if we had not gotten pregnant with the second one so fast, we might have only had one just because of that whole like, well, now they're out of diapers. Now isn't a good time. Now isn't a good time, you know, where when you get pregnant again right away, it's kind of like a, well, guess we're going to figure it out. But I feel like for myself, you know, we weren't able to have more than two, but the sometimes that big family feels like more of an aesthetic thing. I mean, I'm going to assume that people who have eight kids wanted eight kids because, you know, it's kind of a choice. But I feel like sometimes I wish I had more kids in the same way that I wish my kids would wear linen pinafores. You know, like it feels like the right thing to do, but not enough to make me do it. So,
yeah, you know, I get that.
But our house was built. We live in my husband's grandparents' house and they had 12 kids. So, you know, although I guess they were never all 12 of them in the house at the same time, but.
They still would have had to stack them up pretty well for a few years, though.
Yeah, it does. I mean, yeah. God bless the people with that many kids, because I can't even imagine. But, you know, it feels more aspirational to me than realistic.
So, Jen, you're a few more years down the road than us, and I know you seem like the type who wouldn't give parenting advice unless we asked. So I'm going to ask, do you have any good parenting advice that you have learned along the way or that other people have given you that you feel like is worth sharing? And people can take it or not. That's the thing with advice. We're not forcing it on anybody.
I feel like one of the most successful things that we've done as parents is to follow our kids' interests. and work on letting go of those places where we have interests that they don't have any interest in, like farming. But at one point my son said that he was interested in, so I had done karate with my dad at a school about a half an hour away from us and for 4 or 5 years, 6 years. And it was really good for my dad and I. And I happened to mention one day to my son, he was about 8 or 9. I happened to mention to him that the teacher that we used to study with is opened his own school. And my son was like, oh, that's interesting. And we took him for a sample lesson. And then he decided he wanted to keep doing that. And so for the next 7 or 8 years, he and I drove down to that. And not only was it something that was really good for him that he enjoyed and he led and he wanted to do, but it also gave us the opportunity to be in the car together. So I feel like the being in the car together time was really formative for how close we are. Not just because he's an only child, but you know, we didn't have to be close just because he's an only child. And so he doesn't do karate anymore. We don't drive together anymore. But what we actually do now is we have a Saturday night video game session that, and he's moved out into apartments a couple of different times. He's lived with friends. And even when he moves out, like we've spent some time doing a thing that he enjoys doing and he talks to us. And it's really interesting because he says that his friends, like very few of his friends have good relationships with their parents. And he, And he says that he has a good relationship with us. And he's a little embarrassed by that because his friends don't. And I think it's because we spend time with him doing things that he really enjoys. And so that is, I feel like the gift of time is like the biggest gift that we can give our kids. And yeah. And I credit my husband with that because he was always much better at playing. I was always too work oriented. You know, I have to do farm work. I have to do, you know, day job work. I have to do this other stuff. And my husband was always like really good at stopping doing what he was doing and playing with our son. And I've really adopted that now. Just, yeah, we still need to play and we still need to spend time.
Yeah. Yeah, it's important because, I mean, even if you think of the other relationships in your life, the people we want to hang out with, typically it's around our common interests or, I mean, the fact that we like each other too. But if you don't have common interests, and sometimes that requires you to maybe modify a little, like maybe I don't really enjoy this thing, but I really love that person, so I will do that thing with them. And that includes our kids. We can't require them to only do the things that we want to do. We also have to adapt to the things that they enjoy as well.
Yeah. It feels like too, when you do see parents getting involved in things kids like, it feels like a lot of times maybe the parents want to show their kids that they're so supportive that they're like 300% into the thing, and then the kid's like, cool. I wanted you to be like 40% into the thing. And now we're like on the verge of a TLC show about your obsessive interest in my thing, you know? So I think it's a good point that family activities so often seem to center around what adults want to do, or adults being kind of obsessively into what their kids want to do. But I think, there's a healthy medium in there that's really important.
Almost like it's a projection of the adult. So is that what you mean?
Don't judge me.
No.
Yes.
I did that too. And looking back, I see that I did that. Like I had a very different experience in high school than my son had. And I was like, you don't want to go to prom? Prom's great. And he's like, no. And, you know, I mean, there were a bunch of things that I, looking back now, I was like, but I'm excited about this. Aren't you excited about this? And he would be like, absolutely not.
Yeah. And sometimes it's, you know, I don't want you to miss out. But then if you're not really listening to their reasons that they don't want to do the thing, then you're like, oh, that's true. You're not going to have the same experience I did because you don't have the same friend group, or it's not the same type of school, or you really hate dances. So maybe prom will not be fun for you. Can I go to prom and hang out with your friends?
That won't be weird. And so there is that line.
That won't be weird at all.
I've heard of adult proms, so I might want to organize one of those sometime, because I definitely have a teenage boy who I'm just going to go out on a limb and guess he's probably not going to want to go to prom in a couple years. But mom prom, I'm all in. Buy the like thrift store prom dress and go to a dance. Yes, please.
All right. So, Jen, we ask all of our guests, if you're going to dominate a category at the county fair, what would it be?
Oh my gosh. So I will tell you. So I used to compete in our local fair, which is, by the way, known as the Tunbridge World's Fair. Self-described as the World's Fair, 112 years or something that it's been going. It's quite a long time. I used to compete in bakery there and have quite a few ribbons in that. So I feel like my bakery game is strong, but most recently, this is true, I have been competing in the swine obstacle course.
Do you have any pigs anymore, though?
I don't.
Wait. Is it an obstacle course for pigs or an obstacle course like around pigs?
Oh my gosh, great question. It is an obstacle course for pigs.
Okay, because I feel like having worked with pigs, having an obstacle course where the obstacles are swine.
Right, or you're going through an obstacle course and the pigs are running around you.
Yeah, yeah, like you.
That's like a whole new take on a Spartan race that they have not tried yet, is to make pigs the obstacles.
That seems a lot more dangerous, too. Yes. Having worked hogs.
No. It's the former. It's the obstacles taking a pig through obstacles, and there's points if you take them through the tunnel or if you stop in the selfie booth or you get them to go up the ramp and through the tires.
Did you just say selfie booth?
Yes. Oh my gosh. So they set it up so that there's just like a little tape fence that if you can get them to walk into that and to stop, there's a person in the front row that you can take a selfie with the pig and you get like 20 points for that or something. So,
oh, that is fabulous.
It's really, so you're moving them with a pig board, that kind of thing. They don't have to be your own pigs, which is good. Because I don't raise pigs any longer, but I have spent a lot of time in the last 20 years sorting pigs and moving pigs and doing pig behavior stuff. So
now you're just bringing in a ringer hog. Like, are you going to all your friends and just like looking through their piglets for the year to pick out your, I'm just,
or you take someone's 4-H hog. 'Cause this is, sounds like the combination of like a pig showmanship and dog agility. So you like, you could use like a 4-H kids who's done a lot of training and then just, yeah, like you got your cane and your board. And
this feels very ageist and fat phobic for the hog. Because I mean, like if you get, you know, a young barrow, like he's going to have a real different chance than like an 8-year-old sow of like clearing a hurdle or, you know, I mean,
but maybe she pays attention better and can get the 20 points for a selfie.
Well,
oh, I think Jen has more context here.
Jen, no, I'm gonna stop you right here. My New Year's resolution this year was that I'm working on a blanket, like a temperature blanket, but with like my daily habits. You know, so if I get X number of daily habits, then it's one color or it's a different color, whatever. But number one on my list was to be delighted, because I feel like life is just so fucking boring, okay? It's boring. People are like, oh, be happy. I'm like, happy is like entry level. I want to be fucking delighted.
I love that.
The entire concept of a pig agility course is just...
She's going to have a bright color in her blanket this week.
I'm going to be delighted for at least a week by this. Because as soon as we're done, I'm going to YouTube and finding some videos because you know they're there.
Yeah.
And I mean, the Iowa State Fair has a husband calling contest, which I feel like is swine agility adjacent. But we have the world's biggest boar at the Iowa State Fair, too. And now I'm just picturing trying to do it with him because he's usually like 1,000 pounds of basically nose and balls. Like, sorry, Harley.
That would be hard to get him through the stuff. That's quite a visual, by the way.
You're welcome. Well, it's August. It's hot. They tend to lay just...
So there's a strategy to this.
Oh, Katie, she's giving you strategy for when you go to compete next year.
Okay.
There is a strategy to this, which is super, super interesting to me. So yes, you can come and participate in the swine agility without having your own pig, because there are pigs that are there from 4-H or they're from the swine confirmation shows and that kind of stuff. So you can basically like, you can pick your pig, and this is where some of the strategy goes, because you could get a little zippy pig that's going to do the obstacle course faster, but is also going to be faster. So they're much more excitable. You can get like a mid-sized pig, or you can get a finished hog. And so, I mean, you know, a finished hog is still has the ability to run around like all pigs do, but like, it's going to be much more calm. What is fascinating to me, a couple of times I've seen this where they have actually at our swine show, usually they're able to time it out so that there is a sow who has just picked. So there's a whole bunch of piglets that are less than a week old and a mom. And everybody at the fair loves that. But when you bring out the sow and the piglets come with her, if you can run the sow through the tunnel, it's 5 points for the sow and it's 5 points for every one of those piglets. So you may not be able to get the sow through very many things, because if a sow does not want to go somewhere, she does not go.
Right.
But
if the tunnel is one of the first obstacles, then you could cash in right at the beginning.
You totally can. And I've seen friends get really high points values because they were like, I'm going to try it with the sow and see if we could just, you know, and you get points for the number of animals in the catch pen at the end.
Oh,
so,
wow.
Ding, ding, ding.
Katie's hands are literally over her face. She is extra delighted at the prospect of watching all these little piglets go through a tunnel.
Jen, please book the yurt for me during the fair this year.
The World's Fair.
I am not kidding.
September. It's in September.
This is amazing. This is truly amazing.
It gives me delight just thinking about it.
Yes. Thank you. Pigs are the best. We used to raise pigs. I've worked on farms with hogs. They're just a whole different ball game from other animals.
They really are.
I knew someone who used to move her sows by just putting down a trail of Twinkies instead of even bothering with boards or fences or anything, because it was the easiest way to move the sows.
Are you allowed to use food treats in the agility course?
Oh, there's not really enough time. You basically have like a 3-minute time or something like that. So there's not really time to do that. I think that's really a fascinating question. And I don't think there are any rules against it. So I'm like, And I did the first year that I participated, I won, which is really funny. And I've got like a big ribbon and I'm just like, what? And and this last year, I didn't even qualify. Like, it was like, I mean, I qualified for the finals, but I was like way at the bottom because it could just go in any direction at any time.
Yeah. There's so many ways to get points.
Absolutely. And ways for pigs to just do whatever pigs want to do and not what you want to do.
I'm just picturing, Jen, now the movie of my life where the training montage is, it's like Rocky, but building up to hog agility.
That little like the little like teeter totter thing that they put the dogs on, right? Like the
just me and some fat ass sow with like 25 piglets.
My son did rabbit agility a few years ago in 4-H, and it was delightful. But not to the same extent as pigs. I don't think.
I would love to see that. I need to YouTube that.
Yeah, it was also.
I mean, I've been pretty delighted about the rabbit agility, but this is
his was very fat and not very agile, but quite cute. All right. We're going to go into our cussing and discussing because I feel like we all need to get off this call. Yes. And go find YouTube and do some agility. So as our guests or our listeners know, you can send in your cussing and discussing on our SpeakPipe or with our email. So speakpipe.com/barnyardlanguage, leave your voice memo, or barnyardlanguage@gmail.com if you want us to read it out for you. Katie, can you focus for a minute? She's still thinking. All right. She's still thinking about pigs. What are you cussing and or discussing this week?
I'll try, Arlene. So here's the thing, right? If you bear a child with your own body, for a lot of people, that means that your ligaments and tendons and things get a lot looser. And if you then, you know, carry that giant ass baby around and lift the baby and all that, you end up with weird injuries, right? Because you end up with weird repetitive motion injuries. But the part they don't tell you is that your ligaments and tendons and whatever, like, never really go back. So my kids are now 7 and 5, and I'm still getting stupid injuries. Like, I had to have carpal tunnel surgery on both hands because of my children. Well, only the one was because of the children, but whatever. I've had how many cortisone injections into my thumbs? Because apparently that's a thing. I've had to have cortisone injections into my knees because of my children, because that's a thing. Because I've gotten repetitive motion injuries from standing up while holding a giant ass child. But now, even though they're big, I still carry them a little, but not that much. I now have a repetitive motion injury in my middle finger from crocheting because my ligaments and tendons and whatever just cannot even with crocheting. And so now I have like joint fluid leaking out under my skin and my finger keeps locking up. And it's just, it's embarrassing. It's embarrassing to be like, oh, I have tennis elbow, not from playing tennis, from carrying my huge ass baby.
And I was trying to make a blanket and now my hands are falling apart.
Yeah. I was trying to make a nice blanket about how delighted I am about pig agility. And now I'm going to have to put it off for another week. In hopes, and of course I'm Googling this shit, right? And I'm only Googling like legit medical resources because I know better than to just trust Dr. Google. And it's like, well, with splinting, most cases resolve after 10 months.
Of your hands.
Of no use.
No, yeah. Who cannot use their hands?
Cool. That's fine. And I mean, yes, I work on a computer for work, and I'm sure that that is not helping matters. But it's just embarrassing. And it's my middle finger. And unlike my daughter who cut her middle finger the other day and was just like, look at my finger. I can't do that. And
so now your middle finger is splinted.
I am not delighted by this. No. Let's just put it that way. It's a good thing I heard about the hog agility to balance it out.
Cancels out.
Yeah. Jen, what are you cussing and disgusting today?
The hand thing. So I don't have necessarily repetitive motion issues at the moment, but I'm sort of post-childbearing at this moment as well. So I'm in my early 50s, as mentioned. I apparently have gone through menopause. And about 2 years ago, my hands stopped working right. And it has been driving me absolutely nuts. It like messes with my ability to fence. I use a lot of portable net fencing. And if my hands get cold, I drop stuff all the time. It's absolutely been driving me nuts. I used to be able to, I can today make a tight fist with my right hand. But yesterday I couldn't. And so I've got like one finger on each hand that doesn't want to curl all the way in anymore. And it just drives me freaking nuts. So anyway, I have been trying.
Yeah. Not delighted.
Not delighted about that, to the point where it's actually been making me wonder if I've been farming for 26 years without a tractor, and I'm actually considering buying a tractor simply because my hands don't work like they used to work. And so I can't carry things around like I used to be able to do that. And I am with you. Like, I'm cool getting older, but like, could we just have a little bit more aches and pains and a little less like incapacitation?
And the unpredictability too, right? It will work today, but maybe not tomorrow. So
maybe not tomorrow. Like that piece of it is just,
it's always a surprise when you wake up in the morning. What hurts now?
Exactly. Exactly. And
I feel like that would be a solid trade. Like I would trade a lot more face wrinkles or a lot more gray hair or something for my hands working right. Like,
yes.
Let's just see if we can trade the stupid parts of aging for something more like dignified and crone-like.
For the good parts? More wisdom?
The aesthetic stuff? Whatever.
I already look like this. A couple more wrinkles is not really going to hurt anything. Like, you know, this is already what we're working with. So, Arlene, what would you like to cuss and discuss?
Oh, what am I cussing and discussing today? I'm thinking about following our kids' interests, and I love the advice, and it's something I definitely aim towards. But sometimes I just wish that some of my boys' interests were a little closer to things that I care about. And I definitely try my very hardest to pretend that I'm caring a lot of the time. But I can't remember even 10 Pokemons, and I'm definitely not going to remember the however many billions of them that there are. And the one just turned 16, and he's gotten into this very cool, like a Japanese model kit type robot things, and they're awesome. He bought like the little tools to make them with, and I think that's great, but I can't tell them apart. So I even had to bring his younger brothers with me to go birthday shopping, because I was like, I don't know which ones he has, what ones he thinks are cool, like you guys pick them out. They'll be from all of us, because I don't know, but they are very cool. So when he's showing me all the features, I put that like expression on my face that makes it look like I care a lot, and I do care that it makes him happy, but yeah, it's hard to have a conversation because I don't really have anything to say other than what else does it do. And wow,
that's something they should teach you in the childbirth classes, is how to look interested in the things that your kid is interested in. Premarital counseling and childbirth classes.
Tell me more.
So my you would totally vibe on this. My son is super nerd, which I do totally you like connect with the super nerd part, but super, super nerd part where he's super into a thing called Warhammer 40K, 40,000, which has got an incredible, it's got like 40 years. Oh, do you know, Katie? Okay. So it's got like this incredible lore. It has hundreds of books written in it. It's a game, but it's got figures and you print the figures. So my son does a ton of 3D printing in that. So, and he plays with all these different armies. And we've just gotten to the point where I just let him run and he'll just be like, and I'm like, cool. All right. Yeah. And I'll be like, so, you know, I'm not actually following this, right? I'm really glad you're happy, but I'm not going to remember this.
And I don't even know what questions to ask anymore because.
And I don't even know what questions to ask. And then he gets, and then this is because older kid now. I feel like I can say that. Like I wouldn't have necessarily said that when he was like, you know, 11 and like.
Yeah, you don't want to shut down the conversation when your boys, especially, are talking to you. Bring it on.
Exactly. So I say that to him now, and I'm like, cool, that's cool. All right. So I'm not retaining this. I hope you're okay with that. And he'll be like, no, it's cool. I just wanted to like, you know, like vomit that back out. Or I just wanted to overwhelm you with that or whatever. And yeah. He's like, no, that's cool. And he, like, just yeah. The fact that I'm honest about it, but supportive, he's like, yes. I get that you're being supportive. I'm not going to expect you to answer a quiz on this later. And I'm like, oh, thank the maker.
Yeah, you don't need to be on the Discord where he's talking to all the other people who are into this
exactly.
thing.
Oh, exactly. But I know what a Discord is because of him, so I'm grateful for that.
Yeah, that's right. We're doing our best.
Thank you for letting your loved ones info dump about their special interest.
Right.
As someone who has occasionally done the same.
There you go. We all probably have our things that maybe other people don't care about. That's okay. That's why we have podcasts, right?
Yes.
Somebody out there is listening to us.
And they're doing it voluntarily.
Yes, they do. Yes, they do. And they love you.
So thank you so much, Jen, for joining us today. If people want to find your podcast, connect with you online, stay in your yurt, where should they find you?
So our farm is howlingwolffarm.com. And my podcast is choosingtofarm.com. You can find me in both places. And I'm on social media at HWFarmBT.
Very cool. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. This has been so lovely.
Thank you for joining us on Barnyard Language. If you enjoy the show, we encourage you to support us by becoming a patron. Go to www.patreon.com/barnyardlanguage to make a small monthly donation to help cover the costs of making the show.
Please rate and review the podcast and follow the show so you never miss an episode.
You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok as Barnyard Language, and on Twitter we are Barnyard Pod. If you want to connect with other farming families, you can join our private Barnyard Language Facebook group.
We are always in search of guests for the podcast. If you or someone you know would like to chat with us, please get in touch.